Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the two big stories in the New York Times and the Washington Post making headlines. The first in the Times, that the FBI began a counterintelligence investigation into Trump's relationship with the Russians after he fired Comey. And the second in the Post, that Trump has gone to extraordinary lengths to suppress any records and transcripts of his meeting with Putin. Seth Hettner, an award-winning journalist who was a longtime investigative reporter for the Associated Press, whose latest book is Trump Russia, A Definitive History, joins us to discuss the extent to which the walls are closing in on Donald Trump and how the extensive and alarming evidence in his book, along with others, is now beginning to be verified by news reports. And since so much evidence of Trump's criminality and possibly treasonous behavior has been documented, the assumption is that the Mueller investigation, assuming it is released to the public, has turned this information and other intelligence reports into evidence that will stand up in court. Or at the very least, Mueller is likely to provide a roadmap, if not a guidebook, that ties the many disparate reports on Trump's and his associates' suspicious behavior, together with proven malign Russian actions, into a revelation that could be the most shocking, embarrassing, and humiliating political event in American, if not world, history. Then we'll examine reports emerging from Israel indicating the leadership and the military are opening up about the extent to which their military campaigns in Syria against the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps, the Quds Force, and Hezbollah, which amounts to a sustained and secret war against Iran in Syria, which Israel's outgoing military chief, General Eisenkot, said, quote, Israel has struck thousands of targets without claiming responsibility or asking for credit. A specialist on conflict at the Syria-Lebanon-Israel tri-border region, Asher Kaufman, director of the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at Notre Dame University, joins us to discuss a covert war which is escalating while Syria's civil war is winding down. Then finally, with America's Secretary of State apparently believing in the rapture, we'll examine the shrinking constituency that keeps Trump and his administration in office, his so-called base, which is heavily influenced by evangelicals who are Christian nationalists. Catherine Stewart, the author of The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Assault on America's Children, who has a recent article at the New York Times, Why Trump Reigns as King Cyrus, joins us to explain how Christian nationalists see Trump as a miracle sent straight from heaven to bring the nation back to the Lord. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Seth Hettner, who's an award-winning journalist who was a longtime investigative reporter for the Associated Press, where he's covered numerous stories of political corruption and American war crimes. His latest book is Trump Russia, A Definitive History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Seth Hettner.
Thanks, Ian. Glad to be back.
Well, thanks, Seth. And we've spoken about your book, and there have been a number of other books that have done a very deep dive into Trump's business history and his political history, Craig Unger, to mention one, and of course, Greg Miller at the Washington Post, who happens to be the author of the breaking story about how President Trump has gone to extraordinary lengths to conceal details of his conversations with Russian President Vladimir Putin. So let's begin with that, because I think to most people, you know, not necessarily those that have read your book and journalists like me who are trying to figure out what the hell's going on. Most people, I think, got an inkling that there was something wrong in the Trump-Putin relationship at the Helsinki press conference, which followed a secret meeting about which the public or even the government itself has not heard one word about what actually happened. So is that a good place to start?
Absolutely. I think that the president's, you know, obstructing his own administration from insight into his dealings with Putin kind of tells you a lot. It's an indication that, that he, you know, what I've suspected all along, that, that the president has something to hide when it comes to his relationship with the Kremlin. And there's no other reason for him to be so reticent about letting his own administration understand what he's talking about with Putin.
Well, on the other side, of course, the other explosive story, the New York Times story, that that counterintelligence investigators were, after Comey was fired, they were basically asked to look into whether or not the president's own actions can constitute a possible threat to national security. And they were tasked to determine whether Mr. Trump was knowingly working for Russia or had unwittingly fallen under Moscow's influence. What I find extraordinary, none of this is surprising, and I'm sure it's absolutely no surprise to you, Seth, but again, these stories tie other stuff that's been out there and give it a new context. For example, the story in the New York Times that we're just talking about puts into context, at least in my mind, why it is that Trump has been absolutely railing against a number of FBI figures, McCabe, Peter Strzok, and Bruce Orr. All of them have been singled out publicly by Trump, who's absolutely attacked them. And then the Fox News Echo Chamber has vilified these guys. It turns out that every one of those, starting with Andrew McCabe, who after Comey was fired became the acting director of the FBI, it was McCabe who tasked those other people I just mentioned to form this counterintelligence team to look into whether Trump, what is going on between Trump and Russia. So that's a hell of a coincidence, isn't it, he goes after those same people?
Absolutely. Well, just to take you made a couple of points there that I think are worth expanding on a little bit. You know, first, it's not a surprise that Trump is viewed as some people view Trump as an agent of Russia or a possible agent of Russia. You know, that's been said for a long time, even by former government officials. I don't know if you recall, but Michael Morell, who's a former acting director of the CIA, wrote an op-ed during the campaign saying he was going to vote for Clinton because he thought Trump was an unwitting agent of the Russian Federation. So this has been said a long time. What's different is the government acting on this supposition, taking, you know, opening a counterintelligence investigation into the President of the United States. It's one thing for you or I to talk about this or people to write op-eds. It's a totally different thing when the government takes an action. And I think people need to understand that. It brings it to a new level. What's interesting to me is that this story came out now that we have a Democratic House, and today, I don't know if you saw, but Jerry Nadler, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, has said he's going to investigate this and probably bring the FBI agents to testify, probably in closed-door session. But it seems to me like the FBI agents may have come up with something here, and they want this information passed to Congress. And that was, I think, one of the reasons that we saw the story come out when it did. This, after all, happened in 2017 is when the investigation opened, and we're only hearing about it a year and a half later. And to take your second point that, yeah, Trump has been, and he's made no secret of this. And he was asked by Jeanine Pirro yesterday, flat out, are you an unwitting agent? Notably, he didn't deny that he was. He said it was the most insulting thing he's ever been asked. And then he proceeds to go and rail on Comey and Peter Strzok and Lisa Page and all the and Andrew McCabe and all these people who have opened this investigation. So, yeah, he is going after the people who are investigating him. That's exactly what he's doing. And the only reason he's doing it is to stop, you know, the FBI from learning what it's learned. It's again, you know, just as it is with this Washington Post story about the hiding his conversation with Putin, and the New York Times story show is in my mind evidence of guilt that you have a person behaving suspiciously, trying to hide, stop, quash an investigation, and trying to prevent his own administration from learning his discussions with the leader of a hostile foreign power. You know, so that's the back-to-back message that was delivered this weekend.
And again, I'm speaking with Seth Hetton, who's an award-winning journalist who was a longtime investigative reporter for the Associated Press, where he covered numerous stories of political corruption and American war crimes. And his latest book is Trump, Russia, A Definitive History. Of course, the threshold for a counterintelligence investigation is not the same as a criminal investigation where there's a crime and they're looking for who did it or who done it, I guess. In this case, it follows a different path, does it not, where you basically are trying to gather evidence, which may or may not be ever used in court, and basically doesn't determine guilt. Which I guess.
Correct. You're trying to determine whether a threat exists, and then neutralize that threat. So it can go into court. For example, when the FBI rounded up 10 non-official cover agents of Russia who were posing as ordinary citizens, and that did wind up in court. But it does. Those things, even if they do wind up in court, they don't often go to trial because they reveal sources and methods. So usually they stay out of the court system. So we don't know where this investigation went or what it found. It dovetailed in with Robert Mueller's own investigation, so I think whatever was known to those agents is obviously known by Robert Mueller, and presumably will be part or inform his final report. But as far as prosecuting someone for being an agent, Trump. Let me just back up a bit. The funny thing about being an agent is. In Trump's case, he can be an agent of a foreign power and still believe that he's not. And that's what's called an unwitting agent, that Trump is so susceptible to flattery and ego stroking and manipulation.
And money.
It wouldn't take much to get him to take positions, as he has, favorable to Russia and antithetical to the United States. In fact, if you gave him a list, if Vladimir Putin had given him a list of things that he wanted, Trump to take stances he would take out that were beneficial to Russia. Trump has kind of gone down there, just ticking them off one by one. So he's been very beneficial to Russia, and he may still believe that he's not an agent, and yet may be one. And that's what we don't know, because he's hiding his own conversations with Putin, who, I don't need to remind you, is a master manipulator who's trained in KGB. Tactics of manipulation.
Well, Seth Hetton, we know that on December the 10th of 2016, after Trump's election before his inauguration, that Jared Kushner met with Soviet or Russian ambassador Kislyak and the head of the VNB Bank, which is largely referred to as Putin's slush fund, at which Jared Kushner asked for the establishment of a secret back channel between Trump and the Kremlin. And then turned around and Kushner asked for $500 million to bail out a bad real estate investment at 666 Fifth Avenue. But the fact that that happened is just extraordinary. But then if you fast forward to what's happening just in the last week, where Trump made this extraordinary rambling press conference at which he gave the Russian line on rewriting the history of their intervention in Afghanistan. So that, inquiring minds want to know, what's going on here? You wanted to set up a back channel, and now you're parroting the Kremlin's talking points. Does a back channel exist, do you think?
It certainly seems that way. I don't know who the back channel is. It may be Putin. It may be somebody else. But Trump is vulnerable to this kind of exploitation. He uses a cell phone that is insecure. He takes calls directly from world leaders, according to the reporting. So he's totally ripe for exploitation. And I'd be surprised. In fact, I'd be surprised if there wasn't a back channel. We don't know who it is. Trump is repeatedly coming out with these bizarre talking points. As he has throughout his presidency. So someone, and he's not a student of history, he doesn't read books, so someone is telling him these things. We just don't know who.
Well, have you heard reports and rumors that Mueller is concerned that there is a Russian mole in the FBI's office in New York?
I have not seen that, no. Mm-hmm.
Well, there is, you know, obviously this report that he's that Mueller is doing. He's as these new stories they were talking what which we're talking about come out. This puts more. First of all, makes more people more curious and impatient to get the real story from a professional prosecutor. Then, of course, we look at the chaos at the DOJ. Whitaker, the acting AG, who's got his head down now, we know he's been put in there to kind of, to somehow stymie the Mueller report. And then we've got Barr, the new attorney general, designates his testimony next week. He also, like Whitaker, appeared to audition for the job, castigating Mueller to get Trump's attention and therefore get the job. Are you concerned that the very thing that we need to tie all these things together to verify much of what's in your book and other books and to support this recent reporting in the New York Times and the Washington Post, that's on the line? Do you think we'll get the final reckoning here?
I do. I think we tend to focus on, you know, individuals rather than systems. And, you know, Mueller can be replaced or fired, but you can't fire the FBI. You can't fire the CIA. And there are people in the government who have this information at many different levels. And, you know, I think that this information is going to be passed to Congress before too long. So I think there may be, you know, there may be a dramatic firing here and there. You can't, but really this is one of the great saving graces of America is that we have a system of laws that is greater than any individual. And that, I think that will save the Republic in the end if we do have an agent of a foreign power in the White House.
So, and I guess just to finish up on it, Seth, that, Trump seems to only have Jeanine Pirro at Fox to go to now to put out his version of the story, whereas public testimony from Michael Cohen, which I think is going to get huge ratings, along with public testimony from the House Intelligence Committee, are likely to also get more ratings. And, of course, Jeanine Pirro is somewhat conflicted because her husband is a fraudster who was busted by the FBI, and she has a jihad against the FBI. So these people aren't particularly credible on the Trump side, but I suspect that the testimony coming from Michael Cohen and from the House Intelligence Committee is, you know, it's going to be pretty galvanizing, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. There's the problem with credibility is that Trump has none. He's lied so many times, and in fact, he doesn't open his mouth seemingly without lying. That you know that his credibility has been reduced to next to nothing or lower than nothing, if that's possible. But and so someone like Michael Cohen, who also has lied, you know, has more credibility than Trump is a pretty astonishing fact. And yeah, I think this is just the beginning. I think Cohen is going to start the ball rolling, and I think we're going to see. You know, there's a reason why we're seeing all these stories now popping up, and the reason why we're talking is because there are forces working behind the scenes trying to get this information out there and trying to get Congress to take some action, and I think that's what we're going to see in the next year or the final year or two of Trump's first term.
Well, Seth Hettner, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Seth Hettner, an award-winning journalist who was a longtime investigative reporter for the Associated Press, where he covered numerous stories of political corruption and American war crimes. His latest book is Trump, Russia, A Definitive History. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Israel's covert war in Syria. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Asher Kaufman, who's director of the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies and a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. Prior to that, he taught at Hebrew University in Jerusalem and was a research fellow at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace, where he headed up its Middle East unit. And his latest book is Contested Frontiers, Cartography, Sovereignty, and Conflict at the Syria-Lebanon-Israel Tri-Border Region. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asher Kaufman.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks, Asher. And Israel's secret covert war against Iran in Syria has now suddenly hit the headlines. It seems as if both Prime Minister Netanyahu and Israel's former Chief of Staff, head of the military, Lieutenant General Gadi Eisenkot, have gone public with an extraordinary amount of information, particularly from Eisenkot. So what led them to make that change? You know, they would deny if something would blow up in Syria and, you know, Assad would accuse and the Russians would accuse Israel and Israel would be silent. But now they're not being silent.
Right. I mean, Eisenkot is still the Chief of Staff. He has a couple more weeks to go before his term is over. And his public appearance is probably more revealing and interesting than Netanyahu's public appearing about that, because Eisenkot is now concluding his term, and he has had a history of actually keeping a low key in terms of media appearances. So this is very interesting. It may be a sign, or it may be an attempt by him to give some kind of a clear achievements, to provide the show clear achievements of his term as Chief of Staff, the Israeli, the head of the IDF. It may be a sign that he is actually thinking about his next cycle in the public sphere in Israel as a potential politician. It's very hard to tell, but it's clearly he was revealing information that until recently Israel has made efforts to really not to reveal and to keep a low profile in its military operations in Syria. As for Netanyahu, it's more, I think it was more expected that he would make these kinds of statements because he's running for elections. There are elections due in April, and he has all these corruption cases against him, and he is trying to project a public image of Mr. Security, that the Israeli public can only be confident of his leadership and his leadership role in with regard to security. So that his statements about Israeli actions in Syria are more understandable.
Right. Well, Eisenkot, of course, General Eisenkot, has been pretty forthcoming. He said that Israel has struck thousands of targets without claiming responsibility or asking for credit. So we're getting to get some dimensions on this long, war in the shadows that's now come out in the open. There was also, of course, the release of news today that Israel had discovered the sixth and final tunnel. They're assuming it's the final tunnel that was dug by Hezbollah for cross-border attacks. Apparently, these are extremely sophisticated tunnels with rail lines, and they can hold thousands of troops, and they go for thousands of meters inside Lebanon and a number of meters inside Israel. So presumably, they could sort of pop up like a like a whack-a-mole inside of Israel in an attack. The fear that my understanding is that the Israeli military have is that as the war in Syria winds down, where in Hezbollah is pretty tied up, if not bogged down, fighting on Assad's side, those trained fighters will be freed up to man those tunnels and to attack Israel. That's the assumption. So walk us through that immediate story and then the broader story of what Eisenkot's telling us, which is that for God knows how long, months, years, every time Iran moves any kind of equipment or assets into Syria, either for the Quds Force or for the IRGC, Israel pounds them.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think we need to understand the Hezbollah's actions in northern Israel or southern Lebanon towards northern Israel and Iranians' ambitions in Syria as one front. From an Israeli perspective, it is definitely one front. And both Hezbollah and Iran also clearly see that as one front confronting Israeli power, Israeli hegemonic ambitions in the region. And Iran is trying to play the same game of power and hegemony in the region. And the gradual end of the Syrian civil war, at least the current cycle of fighting, which is reaching its final stages, might provide opportunities for Hezbollah to refocus its energy on, the Israeli front. And these tunnels, they have been, they have been dug for years now. So this is not a new initiative of Hezbollah. This is something that has been going on for years. And apparently Israel has known about its tunnels for years and has chosen not to do so. And it's mostly the politics behind it that makes it interesting now, because for political reasons, Israel decided that this is the right moment to expose these tunnels and to block them and to denuturalize them and to neutralize them. And you can see here also again, it's the combination of Netanyahu and Eisenkot playing a very similar game in their decision to expose these tunnels and to create a sort of a media festival around them. I mean, both leaders, Eisenkot and Netanyahu, and in general, the Israeli military apparatus, security apparatus, people have known that these tunnels have been there in existence for years, but they made a decision to reveal them now. And I think it is for political reasons, the decision.
So, in other words, we know that Netanyahu's up for re-election, but Eisenkot might form a party. Is that what you think you're hearing?
I think there are two reasons. First is, again, he needs to establish he needs to leave a legacy after him. Mm-hmm. And Israel has not gone into a full-fledged war when he was, during his term as the chief of staff. And he needs to leave a legacy after him. And I think he's now establishing his legacy.
Right. Well, he's revealing it. He's saying, while I've been chief of staff, this war's been going on, I've been conducting it secretly, and
right.
Now I'm telling you about it. But, I mean, I think a part of the bigger picture, I think, are the economics, aren't they? Because Eisenkot went out of his way to talk about how they believe that Iran has invested about $16 billion in propping up Assad. And we know from demonstrations in Iran that the majority of Iranians, particularly the young and the women, just hate the idea that their government is spending all this money in Lebanon and Syria their economy is going into the toilet. So do you think that's as important as the military front here?
I mean, I think you're talking about the tensions within Iran. I think that the two leaders that symbolize this tension is the president, Rouhani, on one hand, and Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Revolutionary Guard, on the other hand. And Soleimani is the one who is leading the Iranian campaign efforts in Syria and in Lebanon. And both of them, these two Iranian leaders, they represent, almost maybe diametrically opposed views. Too strong of a term, but definitely different perspectives of Iranian power, the way Iranian power should be projected. And I think there are plenty of Iranians who actually side with Rouhani and the more moderate approach towards these regional ambitions of Iran. But Soleimani is clearly tied. I mean, his power base relies on the Revolutionary Guards, on the symbols and the themes of the Iranian Revolution. And he is the one who is leading this more bellicose approach towards Iranians' regional ambitions.
Right, but the supreme leader's son is also a member of the Revolutionary Guard Corps. So, you know, there's no question where the supreme leader comes down on all this.
Right.
And he's the obvious power. And Rouhani and the people may wonder why the hell they're wasting money on in Lebanon and Syria and not, you know, fixing things at home. But they don't have a real democracy, clearly. But what do you think is the what are you hearing from Israel and from the press there about this on and off again U.S. pullout of Syria, first announced by Trump, and that caused Mattis to resign in protest, and then Bolton goes over to the region and says, "Oh, we're not going to do it." And then Pompeo goes and makes this absurd speech in Cairo where he talks about his Bible in his office and closes the speech with, the, you know, praise the Lord to a bunch of Muslims. The whole thing was totally surreal. And, of course, he spent all his time trashing Obama, which is just pathetic. What have these guys done for us, you know? So I don't know where we stand now. Apparently they are starting to move some of the stuff out. There's only 2,000 soldiers. What my understanding is that Netanyahu was really alarmed by this, you know, we all know that Netanyahu and Sheldon Adelson have a lot of pull with this administration.
Right. Yeah. But I think, you know, just like you, I'm sure that the Israeli government, the Israeli leadership, is also confused because it's very hard to detect a coherent strategy policy coming out of Washington these days. It's really hard. It's so confusing. I mean, Trump sends one thing, Bolton immediately, I mean, a few days later, sort of contradicts him. And it's really difficult to tell what is the policy, what is the strategy now behind this administration is trying to lead in the Middle East and elsewhere in the world. I mean, it became a farce now, really, with regards to the Middle East, the withdrawal from Syria, and then Bolton actually correcting it, that it may not be an immediate withdrawal. But recently, I mean, the last 24 hours, we did hear that the American forces are packing up slowly from eastern Syria, northeast of Syria. So it's really confusing, and I think the Israeli leadership is just as confused. And this is a moment where maybe the reliance, Netanyahu's relationship with Trump has proven to be not necessarily helpful for Israel. I mean, if it's in Israel's interest that the United States remains in Syria, then definitely the last couple of weeks have shown that Netanyahu, there is a limit to Netanyahu's ability to shape American foreign policy.
Right, but we're learning that first of all, from Pompeo's speech in Cairo, he spent most of his time, apart from attacking Obama, was going after Iran and making a case that they are the world's biggest danger. And then we're learning that the White House has asked for war plans for a war against Iran. And as we're talking about the fact that Israel's outgoing chief of staff, along with Netanyahu, are now revealing to the public and the Israeli public the extent to which there's been a covert war going on for a long time between Israel and the Iranians in Syria. Just in closing, in the last minute, Asha, doesn't this mean that this war could actually get worse? It could become a regional war, not just in Syria, but in Iran.
Right. I mean, the Syrian civil war has been a regional war in many respects, but we may be witnessing a new phase in this war, because if this covert war between Israel and Iran in Syria turns into an overt war, then I think the tolerance of both parties actually to endure losses, to endure being hurt, might be reduced. Because so long as it has been covert, then I think Iran was able to make decisions not to retaliate against Israel forcefully. Right. Once it's all out in the open, that ability is significantly reduced because it becomes it could become a domestic issue in Iran about, you know, we're being hit time and time again, and why isn't there any response? And the same could apply also to on the Israeli front.
Well, Asher,
on the Israeli front.
Yeah. I'm afraid we're out of time. Sorry to cut you off, but thank you so much, and we'll talk again. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
And again, I've been speaking with Asher Kaplan, who's director of the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies and a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. He taught at Hebrew University in Jerusalem and was a research fellow at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace. And his latest book is Contested Frontiers, Cartography, Sovereignty, and Conflict at the Syria-Lebanon-Israel Tri-Border Region. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into why Trump's base see him as a miracle from heaven. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Catherine Stewart, the author of The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on America's Children. She writes regularly about the political activities of evangelicals and other religious groups and has a recent article at The New York Times, Why Trump Reigns as King Cyrus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Catherine Stewart.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And Catherine, as I'm sure you and everybody else has noticed, President Trump is under siege. Things seem to be closing in on him. He's painted himself into a corner, either keep the government shut down or build my wall, and he even threatened to call a national emergency. But now that emergency has been postponed, which in itself is a bit of a strange turn of events. So that's pretty clear. But the one thing that keeps him in power, all analysts say, is his base. Now, it's never been defined that exactly, but the assumption is that a lot of his base are white evangelicals. So there's no question that they are the bulwark at this point, at least in his thinking. How important do you think they are in terms of being the glue that keeps Trump's base supporting him?
I think this cohort of Christian nationalists is key. In fact, the same day that my piece came out of the New York Times, Joe Heim with the Washington Post published an interview with Jerry Falwell Jr. and asked him, is there anything that Trump could do to cause him to lose the support of his evangelical base? The assumption, of course, is a white evangelical base. Because, as we know, evangelicalism is actually fairly diverse, but it's a white evangelical base that is the core of the Trump support. And Jerry Falwell Jr. said no, just a one-word answer. There's nothing he could do. And I think that this really points to a key fact of the Christian nationalist movement. They, you know, claim to represent the true or real majority of Americans, but they popularized the myth that America was founded on and should be organized about around one sectarian creed. But because our nation is inherently pluralistic, they take a really dim view of truly representative democracy. And this is one of the reasons why they like Trump and compare him to a king. In fact, specifically sometimes to King Cyrus. A king doesn't have to obey the law. He is not from representative democracy is kind of a law unto himself.
Well, explain, if you will, just briefly, Catherine, the analogy with King Cyrus from the book of Isaiah.
Sure. Sure. Cyrus was born in the 6th century BCE, and he became the first emperor of Persia. In Isaiah 45, Cyrus is celebrated for freeing a population of Jews who were held captive in Babylon. So Cyrus is viewed as the model for a non-believer appointed by God as a vessel for the purposes of the faithful. The idea that he may be an imperfect leader, he may do terrible things, but he's actually put there by God specifically for certain purposes. So, in fact, Christian nationalists today talk a very good game about respecting the Constitution and revering America's founders, but they frequently describe Trump as a king. According to Paula White, who is a prosperity gospel preacher who has advised Mr. Trump, she said, "It is God that raises up a king." I was recently at a Christian gathering of so-called apostolic leaders, actually, at the Trump International Hotel, and they kept referring to Trump as a king. You sort of hear a lot of this kind of king language in the Christian nationalist world. So here's a really good example is Ralph Drollinger, who's led weekly Bible study groups in the White House that have been attended by Vice President Mike Pence, and at one point as many as 11 out of 15 of Trump's cabinet members. He has this book, Rebuilding America, the Biblical Blueprint, and in it he refers frequently to kings. He actually uses the word as a verb. He said, "Get ready to king in our future lives." That's what he tells his followers. And he said, "Christian believers will soon, I hope, become the consummate, perfect governing authorities." So, it's this idea that a king doesn't, isn't a part of representative democracy. It's they're a law unto themselves. And that's what makes them perfect leaders in kind of paranoid times.
So the extraordinary thing is that in defending or in propagating this idea of Trump as King Cyrus, the film itself that you refer to in your article, The Trump Prophecy, which came out a month before the midterm elections, is about a firefighter who has an epiphany, and it brings up the idea of the book of Isaiah and Cyrus, who would restore the crumbling walls that separate us from cultural collapse. And this meme has been pushed by, well, first of all, the film that first sparked this idea was produced, I guess, and probably funded by the Liberty University by Jerry Falwell Jr. But it was picked up on Fox News by Jeanine Pirro and also by Israel's ambassador to the United States, Ron Dermer. But Jeanine Pirro, the former judge, she's the go-to person now for Donald Trump. He's in big trouble over the Washington Post story that he deliberately suppressed all records of his meetings with Putin, and the New York Times story that the FBI ordered a counterintelligence investigation into Trump after he had fired James Comey. So he's gone to Jeanine Pirro to correct the record in his mind. And, of course, she's somewhat tainted because her husband is a security fraudster who got nailed by the FBI. So she has a grudge against the FBI. But that's what we're dealing with here. And the one thing that I find common amongst the evangelical right trying to understand its theology, if that's not too generous a description, because so much of it's based upon an interpretation of the book of Revelation and this end of times obsession, which I think at the end of the day, to my mind, is spiritual pornography. And we can certainly talk about that. But what is it about this persecution complex, the idea that Christians in this country are beleaguered and oppressed? I mean, Rush Limbaugh's brother wrote a book about it. It's unbelievable because I've never seen it, been in a country where religion has more freedom and more rights. They don't have to pay taxes, for God's sake. What is their problem?
Well, it's the sense of paranoia is being deliberately stoked, I believe. A clear example is the popularization of this idea that there's somehow a war on Christmas. It really sounds absurd to most of us because we like our Christmas and we celebrate it in different ways very happily. But it's this idea of the tribe, of the insider versus the outsider, the pure and the impure. that really keeps this particular movement together. Look, let's be clear. I mean, religion, as most Americans understand it, has something to do with treating other people with dignity and care of the soul and not writing contempt for them into the law. But this particular movement, the Christian nationalist movement, is really an extremist movement. And in order to sort of maintain their power over their flock, they stoke this sense of paranoia. Tony Perkins, who's the head of the Family Research Council, is very big, very well-funded and powerful right-wing policy organization, looks and sounds like he's from the Beltway and seems quite rational. But, you know, he said right in advance of the midterm elections, he said, America's hanging by a thread over a raging fire. When are they going to start rolling out the boxcars to start hauling off Christians? I mean, if you're hearing that kind of language, if you really feel like your way of life and you're under this existential threat, you don't merely overlook the antisocial qualities of a prospective leader. You embrace them as virtues. I mean, people in those positions want a strong man who's going to, you know, fight for them in the way that they can. And again, I think at the base of this is they understand that they're not a representative movement. And that understanding goes back quite a long way. I mean, it's really a minority movement within our country, but they punch above their political weight because they're incredibly organized and incredibly determined, very coherent. They act in unity when necessary. That's why they put Donald Trump over the top. So way back, you know, at the founding of the movement, Paul Weyrich, who was one of the sort of founding gurus, said at a gathering in 1980, he said, "I don't want everybody to vote." And then he added, "As a matter of fact, our leverage in elections quite candidly goes up as the voting populace goes down." So they understood back then that, you know, truly representative democracy is not what they want, and they're trying to oppose it. I was at the Faith and Freedom Coalition. I think it was actually the Values Voters Conference, and I heard Faith and Freedom Coalition Chairman Ralph Reed speak very glibly about gerrymandering, or what he called the Republican reapportionment advantage. They really are happy about voter suppression because it means that fewer Americans voting means that they'll have more political power. And a lot of their effort goes into sort of turning out their vote, turning out every single one of their members to vote the so-called right way.
But when Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council says, you know, as you quoted, when are they going to start rolling out the boxcars to start hauling off Christians, does he understand that it was a strong man, Adolf Hitler, that put the Jews into the boxcars?
Well, I'm not sure if he what he was thinking when he said that particular line, but there's audio of it, and you can listen to it.
Right. But, I mean, the idea that they want a strong man in the White House, yet they use the analogy of the boxcars, which was one of the probably the most monstrous crime in history, done by another strong man. I mean, I'm trying
to... It's amazing. And Mr. Trump himself understands the longing for the hands of a despot. He said in Lance Wallnau's book about Donald Trump, Lance Wallnau was one of the folks who was represented in that film, The Trump Prophecy. And he said that at a gathering before the 2016 election, Trump said to him and a bunch of other evangelical leaders, he said, "If you don't mind me saying so, you've gotten soft." And they were sort of happy to hear that. They sort of like the idea that they're being given license to act more, you know, in a stronger way, in a harder way. You know, it's interesting. People wonder where, you know, the evangelical support for Trump came from. But Trump has interestingly been courting the evangelical vote for the white evangelical vote for quite a long time, even as early as 2011. He was appearing on radio shows like the 700 Club or TV shows, like 700 Club and other sort of Christian nationalist radio shows in order to sort of familiarize that world with his views and his ideas.
Well, you know, Karl Marx is famously quoted as having said that religion is the opiate of the masses. But I think you could make the case that the Christian right in the United States their religion is the amphetamine of the masses. It doesn't make people passive. It makes people politically active. And so I guess Marx is certainly, I guess he didn't know about the American evangelicals.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think people within the movement really derive benefits from it. The world is a very confusing place. Horrible things happen. And I think the movement gives people a sense of order and belonging. And within their worldview, it gives them the idea of a rational cosmos, an ordered cosmos. But the unfortunate part of that is that the movement really emphasizes distinctions between insider and outsider, pure and impure, which is why members of the movement are so supportive of discriminatory legislation and perhaps don't feel bad about, you know, making other people feel bad with some of the legislation they support.
Well, I'm not sure who's a dominionist in the Trump administration in terms of the people with power and influence within the White House itself. Betsy DeVos is obviously very religious in an evangelical kind of way. We know Ted Cruz's father is a dominionist, but he's not an important player. But it'd be worth looking into, and I'd wish there was more work done on the theology of Vice President Mike Pence and also Secretary of State Pompeo. Now,
I tend to like to use the term Christian nationalism mm-hmm. as a kind of catch-all. I mean, there may be some dominionists within that group and others who are not. But Christian nationalism is the idea that America was founded as a Christian nation. It's a mythological idea, but it's used today to justify political and legal theories that create an idea of what our nation should be. It sort of has this idea, of course, that America is founded on this religious and political identity, and it involves a rejection of the Enlightenment ideals of freedom and rights that it was truly founded upon. So some people within the movement are more dominionist, which means that they have this specific idea that there are sort of seven so-called mountains of culture that Christians like them are called to dominate. And there are many people within the movement who I would not describe as dominionists.
Right.
But I think the movement overall can be described as Christian nationalism. And again, to be clear, this is not all Christians by any means. It's a minority movement within a very diverse faith. And also it doesn't involve everybody who happens to identify as conservative or right wing.
Right.
But it is a specific movement that's captured a lot of political power.
Right. But essentially the dominionists, and I'm pretty sure the Christian nationalists, in terms of the dominionists, my understanding is that they want the Lord Jesus as the head of state, whereas the Christian nationalists are happy to have King Cyrus in the form of Donald Trump. Is that a distinction?
One dominionist we've mentioned in our conversation is Lance Wallnau, right. Who is very clear. He appeared in the film, and he said, "I believe the 45th president is meant to be in Isaiah 45, who will restore the crumbling walls that separate us from cultural collapse." You hear that?
Yeah.
Trump, he thinks, is going to separate us from cultural collapse. So talk about stoking the fear of an existential, right. Stoking the existential fears.
Right. Well, it just gets back to I'm astounded, because if you read the Bible, it's a document about love and compassion, mm-hmm. at least the New Testament. They never talk about the Beatitudes, the Gospel according to Matthew. It's like it never happened. It's all of this weird obsession with the book of Revelation, which I refer to as spiritual pornography when it comes to this movement called Christian Zionism. And little wonder the Israeli ambassador has been pushing this theme of King Cyrus, Trump being King Cyrus. You know, as you know, under Shamir, the Israelis decided to curry favor with the Christian right in this country. The AIPAC lobby was very, very influential in the Democratic Party, but the Christian Zionists has become the tail that wagged the dog in the Republican Party. They're largely, along with Sheldon Adelson, the reason why the U.S. Embassy has moved to Jerusalem. So they have a lot of political clout. But when I asked you about who among the Trump administration at the top level are involved in this kind of weird theology, Vice President Mike Pence comes up, of course, but Pompeo, there's no question about him being one of these believers in the end of times at a mega church in Kansas when he was running for Congress, he, quoting Pompeo, "We will continue this fight. It's a never-ending struggle until the rapture. Be part of it. Be in the fight." So, and of course, Pompeo apparently was a Presbyterian who became an evangelical. He was converted, I guess, by other cadets at West Point when he was there in the 1980s. And Mike Pence started out, I think, as a Methodist or a Presbyterian and then became an evangelical. So that's where you have a conflict of interest. You cannot be a high officer in the United States government. And if Trump goes down, which a lot of people think he will, probably even sooner than people think, then you'll have Mike Pence. If you have a guy that believes in the inevitability of the end of the world and can't wait for something to happen in the Middle East to create the countdown to Armageddon with a lake of fire and all this stuff and all of you and me and everybody else being burned while they get all raptured up, all of these Christian right people, along with, I think, 144,000 Jews, which is not a good deal for the state of Israel, but that's the way they think. So you can't have somebody like that having any access to the nuclear button. That is a direct conflict of interest.
Yeah, any kind of nihilism is incredibly disturbing, and really nihilism belongs nowhere near the center of power. Even sort of, it's interesting, before I started writing more broadly about Christian nationalism, I'm actually working on a book that should be coming out with Bloomsbury Publishing next year. I was writing about these Good News Clubs, which are these clubs in public elementary schools around the country. And they represent a very deeply fundamentalist form of the Christian religion. And their aim is to convert very young children in our public schools to this very deeply fundamentalist form of the Christian faith. And there was a lot of that nihilism, that sort of rapture stuff in the clubs. I remember attending one of the trainings. I attended trainings for Good News Clubs, and there was a song about, you know, this is for kindergartners, first graders, second graders, and they're teaching children to sing, "The countdown's getting lower every day." I remember the tune. I've got a terrible voice. I'm not going to inflict it on you. But just thinking, they're trying to teach little children to believe that the world is about to end, and therefore that's justification for why they need to not only convert to this particular form of religion in their public schools, but also to recruit other children in schools to their cause, and being truly, you know, finding this incredibly disturbing.
Well, Catherine Stewart, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate your article, and I think it's very, very helpful for our audience to try and figure out what is the glue that holds Trump's base together in the face of growing and manifest evidence that he is likely to be a criminal, possibly a traitor, but certainly a divider and a disgrace in many ways that normal Christians would find abhorrent. And I thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Catherine Stewart, who's the author of The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on America's Children. She writes regularly about the political activities of evangelicals and other religious groups and has a recent article at The New York Times, Why Trump Reigns as King Cyrus. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
A lady dressed in white with a man she loved.